On this week's 51%, we recognize World Cancer Day and speak with Joelle Kaufman about her memoir, Crushing the Cancer Curveball. A survivor of breast cancer herself, Kaufman offers up her best advice on how to cope with a cancer diagnosis, how to tell family and friends, and how to advocate for yourself as a patient.
Don't underestimate us, because when we come out, we know how strong we are. We know what we just did. We are fierce.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. February 4th is World Cancer Day to spread awareness of cancer prevention, detection, and treatment. Now, breast cancer continues to be the most common cancer for women in the U.S. The American Cancer Society actually says 1 in 8 women will develop breast cancer at some point in their lives. The good news is that screening methods and advances in medicine have brought death rates down since the 1990s. If you find it early, when the cancer is still localized or constrained to your breast, the American Cancer Society says your 5-year survival rate is over 99%. But again, that's a pretty conditional stat, and that doesn't mean those specific kinds of cases aren't still hard or terrifying to go through. We've done multiple episodes on breast cancer for this show, but not many on the patient perspective. Our guest today has 40 plus years of experience helping people navigate cancer and battling it herself. Joelle Kaufman is a leadership coach and business consultant living in Northern California. Since the age of 13, Kaufman has been caring for loved ones with breast cancer, including her mother and sister. Sensing a pattern, Kaufman got tested and discovered she had one of the BRCA gene mutations that increases your risk of breast and ovarian cancer. She decided to have her breast removed as a result, but literally one day before her surgery in 2023, Kaufman was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer. Her new book, Crushing the Cancer Curveball, serves as both a memoir and a practical guide for the newly diagnosed. Now, obviously, Kaufman is not a doctor, so she's not offering medical advice here or in her book, but she does offer tips on how to navigate the patient experience, from how to tell your family and friends to how to advocate for yourself in the hospital. The book specifically looks at localized breast cancer, but Kaufman says her advice can apply to other cancers as well. Overall, she says she wants to help patients feel a better sense of control over what they can control, and help them feel like they can still live their lives, even when they're fighting for them.
I have 42 years of experience facing breast cancer. I was 13 when my mother first was diagnosed. She's alive and kicking 42 years later. My sister was 29 when she was diagnosed. She's alive and kicking 22 years later. So we seem to be on a 20-year interval for breast cancer with my family. And I was about to have a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy, and I was diagnosed the day before with triple negative breast cancer. And you know, that was shocking and upsetting. And I knew what to do next. And I knew what to do next because I was the 12th cancer diagnosis in my family. And I was the 4th in breast cancer. And I just knew what was likely to happen next and what I needed to do to take the reins as much as possible on this journey. And the benefit, when I talked to all the other women, what you know after you've been through something the first time makes it so much more manageable, or so much more, I don't know, puts you in control more the second time. But the problem is, who wants this thing twice? So I wrote the playbook to give people a map. This is the journey. These are the things that may or may not happen. And here are the things you can do as a patient, as someone who loves a patient, because look, 1 out of every 2 people in the United States are going to be diagnosed with cancer. You will know people.
Given that your mom had it, your sister had it, you were planning to have your breasts surgically removed, you know, it sounds like you had a pretty good idea for a while about your risk for breast cancer.
Absolutely. I joke in the book that I had a frequent flyer card to the breast imaging center and I was global elite status. I had 20 years of mammograms, ultrasounds, MRIs. It actually made the doctors, when I was diagnosed, intrigued because I had an MRI from June that showed no cancer. And in January, I had a 9 millimeter stage two tumor. That's very fast growth, right? That's very fast growth. Now, I have the BRCA1 gene, which is what entitled me to my frequent flyer status. And now there are things like the Wisdom 2 study that any woman between 30 and 70, I think, can join for free. And that's really focused on personalizing the screening because 90% of breast cancers are not genetic. And the women that I interviewed in the book often said, I wondered why, what I did that caused breast cancer. And my answer for everyone is nothing. You didn't do anything wrong. By the way, you should try to be healthy on all fronts because it does make it much easier to endure treatment and to recover quickly. But you didn't cause your cancer. Cells ran amok.
And your sister, I mean, she was young when she was diagnosed. She was 29, and that's well before most women are recommended to start mammograms.
She and again, what they are finding in Wisdom 2, like almost 80% of people in the Wisdom 2 study, she felt something. So you have to touch your breasts. You have to get in that habit, particularly if you're a younger woman, because most younger women have denser breasts and mammograms just aren't as effective when you have denser breasts. And that's why there's personalized screening. But she felt something and her. Something, the doctor said, you're 29, it's nothing. And when it didn't go away for a month, she said, I would like nothing removed. And it was upon removing it and doing the pathology that they said, damn, that's a triple negative tumor. And she was 3 months from her wedding. So she did chemo leading into her wedding. Her wedding was a celebration. And she is, as I said, cancer free and kicking ass. So part of the story that I want to change about cancer. When you hear it, Jesse, when you hear cancer, it's scary and you can't help but think about your own mortality. With breast cancer, if it is not spread through your body, if it is what's called localized, which the vast majority are, there's a 99% 5 year plus survival rate. You want to catch it early because that's how you get those kind of results. But if you catch it early, you can obliterate it. And I knew that when I was diagnosed. And what they did is I was about to have this prophylactic surgery. They said, we do mammograms beforehand just to make sure, because, you know, it's rare, but could be. They did the mammogram and ultrasound. They said, we see something. They did the diagnostic mammogram. We see something. They did the MRI. Yeah, we see something. And then they told me I should reschedule this 14-hour surgery so that they could do a biopsy sometime in the next week. So this is another lesson for people. You have to advocate. So my answer was, no, that doesn't really work. It took a lot to schedule a 14-hour surgery and all the supporting actors. And I knew the vast majority of biopsies are benign. So I don't want to go change the 14-hour thing that I've prepared for if it's benign. So I advocated. I was nice. I said, if you guys can't do it, I'll call around. I'll find somebody who can. I just need this core needle biopsy. And they got back to me in a few minutes and said, we'll do it tomorrow at 8. They got me my answer on the 9th. My surgery was on the 10th. Unfortunately for me, it was malignant.
I mean, I'm glad you were able to advocate for yourself in that way, though, and catch it somewhat early. You know, I think that's something that we struggle with a lot.
Advocating, negotiating is a big part of what's in the story. And you can do it nicely and you can do it with warmth. I wanted to be partners with everyone in the healthcare system. To understand their constraints and figure out ways around those constraints so that I could box cancer into as little time in my life as possible, because I didn't want to spend months and every day of the week in cancer land.
How did you personally come to terms, I guess, with that diagnosis once you got it? And I'm thinking, like, you know, for people watching a loved one who has to battle cancer, do you have any advice for how they can best support them? Because at this point, you've seen both sides now.
If it's you personally, first off, there's no script for how it should feel. You're going to feel a whole bunch of stuff. I tend to recommend breathing and letting yourself feel it. If it means write it, express it, let yourself feel, because that's what takes the intensity out and releases it. How do you know what to do next? Well, my book will say, ask for an oncologist. Oncologists are the specialists who know cancer. For breast cancer alone, I've calculated there's at least 120 variations. So my breast cancer has nothing to do with somebody else's. Oncologists are masters of all of those complexities and all of those protocols. You usually, with solid tumors, don't have to move at light speed, but you know, within a week or two, you should be with an oncologist. The exception are the blood cancers like leukemia and lymphoma. You have to move faster and your doctors will move faster. Like, your doctors are interested in saving your life, and so they're gonna tell you some pacing. Then you, if you're the person, you have to choose how you want to communicate and when. And again, there's no rule. I had a lot of people who knew I was having surgery the next day. My kids were home from college, the two that were in college. I was forced to share the news very quickly. I chose to use something called Caring Bridge because I could share it once and direct people to that. And they could keep up there, which allowed me to control how often I had to talk about it, because I could say, look, can you just check the Caring Bridge? And my conversations with people could be about their life. That's the bridge to what do you do when someone tells you you're going to feel bad. It's not their job to make you feel better. So recognize, okay, I wasn't expecting that. Take a breath. And then say, I am so sorry you're going through this. And I'm happy to figure out things I can do to help. Or if you have a list, show me where to sign up, but I'm here for you. And that's it. Don't tell them to be strong. Don't tell them you got this. Don't tell them, you know, you're going to beat it. You have no idea if any of those things are true. And you're actually putting pressure on them to make you feel better. You don't want to do that. You actually want to say, I'll hold you. I'll lift you up. I have a chapter in Crushing the Cancer Curveball that gives all kinds of ideas. If you are someone who loves someone facing cancer, so many different things you can do. And I call these things happiness tripwires. And a happiness tripwire, Jesse, it's a 15-second thing that makes you smile, just like that, right? One of my favorites, one of my my sons were away at college. One of them loves music. I made him the DJ for my infusion days. So I had music. The other one is a wonderful writer. And I asked him if every Wednesday for Infusion Day, he'd send me a letter. They were digital. They're about his life. But I got 12 letters from my 19-year-old son, and it was digital chocolate. So you can send someone a text or a letter that just says, I'm thinking of you, or remember that time we did that crazy thing? And what you're sending is a smile.
You mentioned something called Caring Bridge. Is that a website?
It is, caringbridge.org. And people use it and they can control how public it is. So I made my Caring Bridge only available to people I invited. Other people post it on Facebook or Instagram, and everyone can follow. These are choices that we make. I'm obviously not private about my journey at this point. I just wrote a book about it. But at the time, not only was I a little private, but I was very clear with people. When I told them, I said, I have been diagnosed with stage 2 triple negative breast cancer. It's the same cancer my mother and sister had. Here is what I need. I love your stories, your support. I love hearing about your life. I need an oncologist. So please, referrals are welcome. I do not need stories about other people's cancers. And I do not need links from Google. Dr. Google is not my oncologist. Nor would ChatGPT be my oncologist or Perplexity. Like, I wanted an oncologist and their love and support. And that helped people, because I said, this is what I need. And by the way, this is what my kids need, right? Please use the Caring Bridge. Don't ask my husband and kids for updates all the time, because I've been that person, and it's depressing and it's exhausting. So I happen to like to write. Other people have asked a friend to be their Caring Bridge writer, right? This is what's going on. And it just gives people a way to stay in the loop. And then when they are reaching out to the patient or the patient's family, they can send joy. They can send happiness. They don't send work.
I like that. You know, just the idea of rooting for someone in a way without putting a lot of pressure or extra worry on them. You know, when it comes to seeking treatment, obviously there are a lot of different types of cancer and ways it can progress and play out. So everyone's treatment might look different, but are there any key lessons that you learned firsthand when it came to navigating your treatment or finding a doctor?
Yeah. The first thing is you have to understand that cancer is a dramatic plot device for movies, books, theater. So it's very unusual that, you know, you'll hear a run-of-the-mill cancer story because, frankly, there's no drama. But most cancer stories are run-of-the-mill. I mean, they're all unique and they have their challenges and none of them are fun. But, you know, they're not these dramatic, you're going to lose all your hair and you're going to be weak. I mean, this is my hair. I don't know if your listeners can see it, but I had chemo under 2 years ago. Okay, hair doesn't grow this fast. I didn't lose the majority of it. Now, that's because my cancer responded to a less toxic chemo and I used cold capping. Okay, so number one, what you've read, what you've seen in movies, what you've seen on TV, mostly is not what your experience will be like. So take a breath. Number two, your order of operations depends on the pathology of your tumor. So you need an oncologist. What is right for some people may be completely different. So for example, and I said, my mother, my sister, and I all had the same pathology. When my mother was diagnosed 42 years ago, the first thing they did was surgery, get it out. It came back 2.5 years later in the same place. So it was probably just a cell that was missed. And then she needed chemo and radiation and, you know, the whole nine yards. When I was diagnosed, I said, well, my surgery's tomorrow. We'll just continue and then we'll do what we have to do. And the surgeon said, no, for your kind of tumor, we see that doing chemotherapy before surgery, it's called neoadjuvant, has a better outcome. Now, when I met with my oncologist, who was recommended by multiple people when I put out that message, hey, this is going on, and what I need most in his oncologist, you know, things kept pointing to this wonderful person. And Dr. Chen explained to me, she said, when we do chemotherapy before removing the tumor, we monitor how the tumor is responding to the chemotherapy. And what that means is we are able to make changes and possibly avoid more toxic chemos because the tumor responded to the less toxic one. So anytime you can do less toxic versus more toxic, I would choose less, right? So I did have chemotherapy. My tumor responded to the less toxic one, which was great because I kept my hair. I wasn't nauseous. I did things, that's in the book too. I did things to stay ahead. So when you are going through treatment, you want to understand what the possible side effects are and what you can do proactively to minimize them. Because once the side effect is started, you're uncomfortable and it's actually hard to reverse. But if you stay ahead of it and it never gets momentum, you're in really much better shape.
That's interesting. So when you say staying ahead of it, do you mean like anticipating what your side effects are going to be or like weighing your treatment options based on them or just accepting them for what they are and like mentally preparing yourself?
Understanding which ones are most likely, because they tell you about all the side effects and a bunch of them are like 1-2% and there's nothing you can do about them. So anything that's a roll of the dice, put out of your head. Hope for the best. Anything you can control, nausea, neuropathy, mouth sores, hair loss, choose. Choose what you want to do. So I hated the ice mittens and ice socks that minimize neuropathy. I didn't like them. My hands hurt and my feet hurt. And it was not pleasant. But I really didn't want to have tingles in my fingers and toes, because that can last for the rest of my life. So I endured something unpleasant to prevent something that I thought would be more unpleasant. In advocacy, when they were describing the chemotherapy and the way the day would work, I asked for a stronger antiemetic, one that suppresses vomiting for 3 days. Now, the reason I asked for it is I knew my mother and sister had very strong reactions to chemo. I really don't like nausea. I don't know who does, but I really don't. And I didn't want to experiment and see how it went for a cycle because I'd rather just not be nauseous. Chemotherapy flushes out of your body in 48 to 72 hours. So I asked, they said, okay. And so I did that. And then I did the medications they sent, and it turned out I was over-medicating and it was causing other problems for me. And my doctor said, yeah, let's throttle that back. So one of the things I did on my website, and I talk about it in the book, is I created trackers, digital trackers. They're Google Sheets, right? And I tracked different side effects, different meds, and I'd share that with the doctor when I saw her every 3 weeks. The benefit was Dr. Chen knows exactly what she's looking at, and I don't have to remember what happened 3 weeks ago or last week. I can just say, oh, it's here in the sheet.
We're speaking with Joelle Kaufman, author of Crushing the Cancer Curveball. Now, obviously, your cancer journey started when you were already getting a mastectomy, but you know, for a lot of women, having their breasts removed might be a part of the treatment process. So, and I hope this isn't too personal, but you know, how did you kind of come to terms with having your breasts removed and navigate decisions like, you know, like reconstruction?
Because I have a genetic mutation for breast cancer, there really wasn't a lot of debate. Once that gene has been active, there's a higher probability it will do it again. So for me, the recommendation was bilateral mastectomy. And I had already accepted that because I was going to do it prophylactically. I had mourned. I enjoyed my breasts until they tried to kill me and then they had to go. But I made a friend. I write about her in the book. During chemo treatment, we had the same tumor, same type of tumor, same pathology. We're on the same treatment schedule. She was 38. And their recommendation to her was lumpectomy with radiation. And that's what she did. So the choice, and by the way, if you have a mastectomy, you have choices about the type of reconstruction. My reconstruction repurposed belly fat to reconstruct my breasts so I don't have implants. But other people choose implants. So you have choices, and it's okay to ask to see pictures. It's okay to ask, are there other people who've done this I can talk to? You should ask, like, what are the typical types of complications or follow-on surgeries? For example, my surgery is a big surgery, right? It's anywhere from 6 to 14 hours, depending on the surgeon and the complexity. But there's very few complications after that. You do an optional revision surgery and that's done. Now, implants, some people have to have expanders. So there's multiple surgeries. There's just different things for different people. I'm not recommending one over the other. It's incredibly personal. But you as the patient can say, I'd like to talk to a reconstructive surgeon. I'd like to see pictures. By the way, the pictures are particularly important if you're a woman of color, because scarring and the way the body looks can be different. I know people who have created a booklet about that, but it is important to ask, I'd like to see, I'd like to know what I'll look like. And people should know if you do have the mastectomy, you lose sensation. The nerves are cut. If you have a lumpectomy, you keep sensation. If you have a mastectomy, you're not going to have mammograms anymore because there's nothing to scan. It's all self-exam and your doctor's doing exams. If you have a lumpectomy, you'll still have screening. And then people worry about the risk of recurrence. If you have a bilateral mastectomy, you may feel like, well, I have less to worry about. Statistically, the survival rates are the same.
You mentioned earlier that having cancer isn't always or isn't often like it is in the movies. Is there anything else that you think people commonly misunderstand about going through something like early stage breast cancer? Because I think we definitely don't see a lot of life after cancer on the big screen either.
My cancer year was one of the happiest years of my life. I've never felt so loved, so supported, so held. And I hate pity, and I'm not somebody who asks for help easily. And I was able, and I recommend this through the book, I was able to ask for the things that I knew would help me and my family and be clear with people, like, I don't want to have a pity party. I'm okay. I'm going to be okay. I need support to get through this. And people were great. So a lot of people are afraid, will I get fired? Will I, you know, will people treat me differently? And, you know, they may not, they shouldn't fire you. I tell employers, like, people can work. Depending on what your job is, work may even be an upper. But even if they have to take a leave because the kind of work they do, Jacqueline, for example, is a nurse. She can't work during treatment because she can't be exposed to, you know, the different infections and what have you. But she went back to work. She's awesome. Like, this is not taking us out. This is temporary. So don't deny people career opportunities, progression. Don't underestimate us, because when we come out, we know how strong we are. We know what we just did. We are fierce. And we have the gift of what I call the cancer filter. The cancer filter is a really swift prioritization engine. This is important. This is not. These are the people I want in my life. These are not. And our lives, you'd never choose cancer, Jesse. You'd be crazy to choose it. But your life is better after it, because you have this strength. And by the way, after it can be a long time. I mean, I have friends who've had complications and, you know, it's just dragging on. So it can be a couple of years, and that sucks, right? But it will end. And when it ends, you look back and say, damn, I did that. And that's a very powerful feeling. You may also have the, you know, I can't believe that happened to me. I believe in getting mental health support and processing all of those feelings.
Joelle Kaufman is the author of Crushing the Cancer Curveball, a playbook for the newly diagnosed and their family and friends. It's out now online through River Grove Books. And if you want to learn more about Joelle and her work, you can check out her website, joellekaufman.com. Thanks for joining us for this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcasts.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along. Nightmare down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool, no electricity, hot rain on the concrete, sweet.